Today is September 26th, the year 2000. We're in Washington, D.C. at the home of Ralph and Lillian Smuckler. I'm Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. Ralph Smuckler for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial to be commemorated in the year 2005. Dr. Smuckler, do you give us permission to tape record this interview today?
I certainly do.
I'd like to start first with some questions about your personal and educational background. Where were you from, and where did you go to school?
I went to school in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Washington High School was my alma mater. After that, I went to, after some months actually, I was in the Army for a while. When the war ended, I came back and attended the University of Wisconsin. Did a PhD in political science there. And finished up the year I came to Michigan State. My dissertation was almost finished, and I moved to the university in East Lansing.
Mm-hmm. Had other members of your family gone to the University of Wisconsin? Or
The only members of my family that ever went to a university went to the University of Wisconsin.
Okay. Yeah. So there was a tradition.
My father was a graduate of the University of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Had it not existed, he probably never would have gone. But he was a very, very bright student in a small town in northern Wisconsin. And he was offered by his uncle or his cousin or somebody to be supported at the university. But at that time, Wisconsin was free. And he went, and he worked, and he made his way.
I see.
And then my sister came along, and she went to the University of Wisconsin.
Your World War II experience, would you talk a little bit about that?
I was 17 when I enlisted in the Army. And I enlisted in the Army at the age of 17 in order to be sent for special training and education. I went off to the Army Specialized Training Program. I was a part of the reserves in that program for about a year shortly after I was 17 when the about 3 months into it, the program was abandoned, and I was sent immediately into infantry basic training down in Texas. Went from there to immediate assignment to a division that was heading overseas. So I celebrated my 18th birthday in the Army, and I'm trying to remember whether it was it would have been my 18th birthday in the Army in training, actually, and then shortly there, by my 19th birthday, I was overseas in northern France, fought with in the pockets of Lorient and Saint-Nazaire, finished up safely, was sent then to Austria actually, we were in the occupation down in Arles, France for a while, and then our division was sent up to Austria, and it was broken up, and I was assigned to training as a clerk typist. The Army needed people to keep the records. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, they picked me out and sent me off to that school, which was in St. Wolfgangsee. And I ended up at the age of 20, having earned enough credits for overseas service to come home. And that was good because Lil and I got married shortly thereafter, within 3 weeks, and went off to the University of Wisconsin to get educated. Under the GI Bill, which was a great thing for all of us.
What was Wisconsin like at that time, at the end of the war, with the return of all the vets?
The place was swarming, as was East Lansing, with veterans. And we were lucky. One reason we got married so quickly was that we had a place to live in Madison as a married couple. We had an apartment that we were able to locate. Lil was able to locate before I got home, and we were already engaged, got married, and went to live in Madison. It was a lively place, a lot of excitement, a lot of GIs who had been all over the world.
Your bachelor's degree, what field was that?
I was in economics, and it was a multidisciplinary degree for international affairs. And I became interested in international service as a result, I think, of my work in the not only during the fighting, but also in the occupation in Europe. Took a strong interest in it and came back to study international affairs. And Wisconsin had a multidisciplinary degree, which involved geography, economics, and political science. And it was a good degree. I majored in economics in that track, and then went on from there to a PhD in political science within the international interest.
Was there anything that you saw in the occupation that maybe directed you? What was it that you did that
caused you to pick that field? After being trained as a clerk typist, I was sent to Vienna and served there for about 3 months in General Clark's headquarters in G3, which was the intelligence section. And that sounds very glorious. I was then 19 years old. It was so glorious because they gave me a Jeep. Mm-hmm. And as the Jeep driver, I presided also over the message center. And that meant I made the rounds of all the embassies that Clark was dealing with and took messages and picked up things and all that kind of stuff. So I got to know Vienna and I got to know the embassies pretty well. Mm-hmm. I think that sort of sparked my interest. I saw a lot of these Foreign Service guys around, and I never talked to any of them. I was just at that time, I don't even think I had the dignity of a PFC. I was a private at that time.
Private.
Yeah. So, but I think the whole war experience said to me that I wanted to be active in the world.
Did you have language other than English at that time?
I studied some French before I left for my initial stay in at the university. I went to the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, waiting for actually coming into service. Mm-hmm. I was 17 at that time, and I had about 3 months before they pulled me into the AST. And I studied French. I studied a lot of French over the years, and I always found that I never got anything less than an A. Mm-hmm. And I took enough French courses to have been a major. Spent a lot of time in French literature study, as well as French language study. When I got over to Vietnam later and had to use it, this is some years later, I couldn't speak it. Mm-hmm. And that frustrated me. It made me think a good deal about how we teach languages.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
When you first came to Michigan State, how was it that you ended up at Michigan State?
A very good offer. Actually, it's a funny story. My dad, because he never had a support me at the university. Lil worked, and I worked, and we had the wonderful GI Bill. So my dad and mother, who had saved for my education, ended up having about $3,000 in the bank that they didn't need. I didn't need. And they gave it to us as a gift in the form of a new car. And with a new car, I was at the top of the ladder in graduate school. I only had it for about 6 months there, or for the last year actually, of graduate school in Madison. And during that last year, the political science convention occurred in Minnesota, the APSA meeting, and we loaded six of us with me driving, and we went in my splendid Olds 98. To Minneapolis, and there Michigan State was recruiting, and I wasn't looking for a job yet because I hadn't quite finished, but some of the guys brought me into the Michigan State session where Ed Widener, a bright, young, able guy who was new in the faculty and trying to organize a governmental research bureau in political science, was speaking, and then later he set up a series of interviews with anybody that wanted to meet with him. Well, I went in and met with him. And so did a number of other Wisconsin graduates. Ed himself had attended Wisconsin at one time, a long time before, and had already established a reputation before being hired to Michigan State, a reputation at Minnesota and UCLA. He was only about 5 years older than I was, but he was established in the field. I don't think he served in the war, but in any case, he was there, interviewed me. And lo and behold, a matter of months later, I started getting phone calls. And that was it. And they made me a good offer. I was offered a salary of $4,500.
$4,500.
Which I think was about the best offer that anybody got in political science at Wisconsin that year.
Mm-hmm. When was your first trip to campus, or what do you remember?
He invited me over. There was a position open in the Governmental Research Bureau and in political science, introductory politics. And Herb Garfinkel from the University of Chicago was also interviewed for that position. And Herb was selected for the straightforward position. I was then asked to take a position open for a year in international politics because they saw me as having that special interest, which I did have, and the training. So I took the position for a year, but I never left. After that, there was one thing or another always in political science until I moved into the international program. And I think the Governmental Research Bureau was the main attraction when I first went. That plus the fact that Jim McCamey, my major professor at Wisconsin, said Michigan State's a good place to go. They made you a good offer. You should take it. So I did. Had no reservations at all.
Did the university or the federal government provide that funding for the Government Research Bureau at that time?
That was the university.
That was the university?
State, okay. The state of Michigan, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When did you meet John Hanna for the first time?
Let's see. I didn't meet him until, well, I'd see him in big meetings, but an instructor in political science doesn't meet the president except under special circumstances. And I didn't really meet him until came back from Saigon.
Okay.
That would be in 1956, mm-hmm. early January of 56. I came back in December of 55. Mm-hmm. No, wait a minute. I've got a year off here.
Okay.
We went over in 55, came back in December of 56. In January of 57, I met Hanna.
Okay.
During the year I was back, yeah. And that was a good, because the international program that I was being recruited into by Glenn Taggart and by Hanna was sort of the apple of his eye. I got to see him very often after that. He was a strong influence on my own role at the university.
What was Glenn Taggart's position at that time?
Glenn had just been appointed in late 56 to be the first dean of international programs.
Okay.
He was also a professor in sociology and I think a part of the experiment station, or extension service, sorry.
Okay.
But Glenn had joined the university a year or two after I did, I guess, in the early 50s, and he already knew Hanna. Hanna was one of those that recruited him there because of his having served in the USDA. Mm-hmm. And Hanna was, of course, active in USDA affairs.
Mm-hmm. What when you first got to campus, what were some of the early courses that you taught?
I taught municipal government, state and local government, introduction to political science, poli sci 7 it was, and a U.S. and world affairs course, which was the apple of my eye. That's the one I wanted to teach. I think I did all right in the others, but I had never taken a course in municipal government. I avoided it. I never took a course in state and local government. I avoided it. But there I was, using Ed Widener's textbook and teaching those courses. And I had 75, 80 students in it wasn't a lecture session, it was a class, mm-hmm. where I'd meet with them three times a week and try to get to know some of the students. It was not an easy teaching assignment because I taught, I think the first year I taught 12 credit hours each term. One term I went up to 15 credit hours. Mm. And in addition to that, was half time. The other half half-time. Was the Governmental Research Bureau.
And in your spare time, what did you do?
Mm-hmm. In my spare time, I dreamed of teaching the World Affairs course, which I did. Leroy Bennett, who was then on leave to work at the UN and who vacated the position that I was appointed to for 1 year, had been teaching in the international field directly. And then he left after a year, and I moved into the international field.
Mm-hmm. How did you first meet Wesley Fischel?
Wes was my office mate right from the very beginning in political science.
Mm-hmm. And where was political science housed at that time?
We were in the basement of Morrill Hall.
Of Morrill, okay. Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of the center of things in the sense that Morrill Hall had a number of major departments housed in it. Economics was there, some of the arts and letters departments were over there. Mm-hmm.
Why don't we talk a little bit about the Vietnam Project and how MSU got involved, or how you were involved in that project. I know it'll be coming out in your book and that sort of thing, but maybe if you could,
talk a little bit about it, because there's a hell of a lot of foolishness that's said about it, in my judgment, foolishness. Wes Fischel maintained, he was a Far East hand. He was a Japanese language specialist during the war and had been over in the Far East and had met various people. He knew an Okinawan, whose name escapes me, who was a political scientist and eventually became the head of the university, one of the universities in Japan. And he knew a Thai professor of political science who became president, I think, of Chulalongkorn University in Thailand. But another person he knew was a man by the name of Go Dinh Diem. And Diem was Vietnamese. He was a strong Roman Catholic. He had a brother who was a bishop. And the family was well known as a Catholic family. And Wes wanted to, at some time, do a little study of the effect of the influence of the Roman Catholic Church in the Southeast Asian setting. He had a friend in Thailand. He had Diem in Vietnam. And Wes, in the Vietnam, after a few years, we all became aware of the fact that France was hanging on in Vietnam and that the war was going on and on. And Wes invited Diem to come and visit Michigan State. I don't know if Wes did it. I think the Governmental Research Bureau invited him. And at that time, Diem was, I think, in one of the seminaries in the East Coast. So he came out for a few days, and I had numerous contacts with him, being in the same office as Wes. And he gave forth at several seminars describing some of the things that he felt his country needed. And that was about it. He went back home, and Ed Widener and Wes talked a lot about how they might develop some kind of an aid program. That was the period in which the University of Michigan's work in the Philippines was well known to us because it was in public administration, and that was a part of our department. And we knew some of the people who'd been out to the Philippines for the University of Michigan. And the Indiana University people were getting involved in Thailand, although that came along a little later. They were exploring it a bit later. And universities were getting engaged in technical assistance. And Michigan State at that point had several projects, one of them in Columbia in agriculture, one of the first of the Point Four programs under the Truman Point Four program. We had a major involvement in Okinawa, which Milton Melder certainly helped to develop. The American Council on Education had asked us to get active there, and Melder put it together on behalf of HANA. So we had two projects. Columbia was pretty much unknown to me because that was agriculture. And in those days, and unfortunately over many years, if you were in agriculture, you were over there. If you were in social science, you were over here. And if you were in arts and letters, you didn't talk to either of them. You know, the whole thing was You know, university was united only by the parking problem. But we didn't know what was going on in Columbia, but Ed Widener knew quite a bit of what was going on in Okinawa because Guy Fox from our department went out there among the first. And Milton Melder was at that point chairman of our department in the early period, the first year I was there. And therefore, we knew a lot about Okinawa. And it was that kind of formula that prevailed in the discussions with Ziem in the early time. But I became involved because having met him in the university then, once he became president after Dien Bien Phu, after the fall of the French at Dien Bien Phu, once he was president, he invited Michigan State to immediately send out officials, send out a team, all this kind of stuff. And I, as an active member of the department, was asked to be one of the Michigan State team members. That was in late 54, early 55. We ended up going to Vietnam in 1955 I think we left on July 4th for Vietnam.
That was your first time in that country?
Yep. Mm. Yep.
What were your
first
impressions?
First time in Asia.
Uh-huh. Yep. What were your impressions?
Vietnam is a beautiful country. My impressions were based on the first day we were there, my family, we had two small children. Lil and I had, we were assigned a storeroom in the hotel for the first night because they had run out of hotel rooms in the Hotel Majestic. So we slept in a basement storeroom that we couldn't lock because there was no wall up to the ceiling. It was just a partial wall. And we got through the night all right. And the next day we moved into a regular hotel room. But that night there were mobs in the streets shouting up at the hotel. And for me, that was very exciting. But Lil kept saying, keep away from the windows. So we had turmoil the first few days. And a young political scientist, all kinds of excitement this presented to me. And we had three or four nights like that in which we were being told by our Vietnamese counterparts who were watching out for us in our new office facility and all of this, we were being told that this was a demonstration against the International Control Commission, which had been set up under the terms of the temporary partition. And the International Control Commission had Indian, Canadian, and Polish diplomats on it. And since their staff, and some of them were in the hotel and had just had a meeting that Ziem's government disagreed with very strongly because it was very limiting on what Ziem could do, that is, the decisions made at that meeting were. The mob in the street was an orchestrated mob, as most mobs, as you gradually learn in political science or anything, most mobs are orchestrated in one way or another. This one was orchestrated by Ziem's government, probably, to protest the ICC's decisions, which were not friendly to the Ziem government. And so we didn't worry about it. But about the fourth or fifth morning, we went up to the dining room where we had breakfast each day, and some of the waiters, our little kids, Gary, who was then age, I think maybe six, maybe seven, and Sandy, his little sister, who was just 2 1/2, had befriended the waiters, and the waiters got a hold of us as we came in. They said, leave the hotel, get out of the hotel. Something's going to happen here today. So we had already scheduled Lil to go over and visit Gene Widener in a house that they had. Ed was chief of party at that point. And Lil and the kids, I took them in one of these little Volkswagen taxis, all four of us squeezed into it, and we got out to Gene Widener's home. And I left Lil and went back to the office to work. And about 11:30, 12:30, there was all kinds of turmoil in the streets. And we began to wonder what was going on. But we learned through a Vietnamese contact of ours who came running in about noon saying that the Hotel Majestic is kaput, it's dead. And what did that mean? Well, in his language, it meant that it was finished. And that was bad because we had Michigan State people in that hotel at that very moment. So we went running down the Rue Catinat to the hotel, and by the time we got there, the hotel indeed had been looted, among other things. The wine cellar had been broken into, and the whole first floor was covered. In the basement, the first floor was covered with wine. And if you could get through the slippery areas, you could get your way to your room, which I did. I went up to our room, which had been broken into, and all of our stuff had been strewn around, and a few things had been cut. And I gathered everything up in a big sheet off the bed and carried it out like Santa Claus. Fred Wickert had his family in the hotel, Dorothy Wickert, and their two daughters were in the hotel. And Dorothy had was able to speak some French, and she sat the invaders down. They were just kids, you know, they're high school kids. They were taking advantage of a situation, and that's not what Diem wanted them to do, but there they were. They took over the hotel. And Dorsey, John Dorsey's wife, was in the hotel with her two kids, too. And there were a few others like that. And they, too, had been able to calm the kids that were trying to invade enough so that they didn't lose very much. But Guy Fox, who had moved into the hotel the day he was joining the team that very day and had arrived at the airport, found his way to the hotel with his brand-new stuff from Hong Kong. It's supposed to last him 2 years. Completely wiped out. Lost everything. None of our people were hurt in the process. There may have been a few people roughed up, but not Michigan State people. And it was rather terrifying. So my first impressions of Vietnam are based in part on that experience. But each night from then on, there were bombs going off in the city. We were put into, because the hotel was unusable, we were put into an apartment that was supposed to be ready in about 3 weeks. So it really wasn't ready. It was pretty bad accommodation, but you took what you could get. And the family adjusted to it. And each night we'd be awakened by the sound of artillery or bombs. And it was one night we woke up and there was a lot of sirens outside our window. We were right on one of the main streets. And we looked out and saw the police and some army vehicles, and they were all working their way to surround and to try to get up the pole to look into the defense of a relay station that was on that post out there, telephone relay station. And we learned then, the next day, that the reason they were so numerous and so cautious was that several of these relay stations had been blown up that night. And there were bombs going off from time to time, even during the daytime. I remember walking down Rue Catinat one day with bombs going off of 2-3 blocks away. And I kept telling Lil that because of my experience in the infantry, I could tell when something was close and when it was far away, and I knew what incoming artillery sounded like pretty much from the army. And therefore, you know, I kept calming them down. But one night in particular comes back to mind, and that is that we heard clearly it was artillery on this occasion, not bombs. And the artillery kept going from about 4 o'clock in the morning on for about 2 hours. And I kept telling, well, it's at a great distance, and it's probably artillery fire practice. You know, the Army's practicing with artillery. Well, we learned the next morning that they had been reducing the stronghold held by, I think it was the Binh Xuan or one of the other river, what were called in those days, pirates. And I think that's really what they were. And they had taken over that stronghold and defeated the opposition at that point. And so Lil used to kid me about calling everything practice and artillery practice. Don't worry. But that was our first impression. I worked immediately on the library of the National Institute of Administration. We were, you know, I'm leaving out being introduced around to various people, but I had a counterpart immediately at the library. I was the research director for the program. And he and I planned the library in a facility that had been designated for that purpose. And Mr. Sue was his name, S-U-U. And he was a nice gentleman who began to educate me about Vietnam. And by the time I left there, a year and a half, 2 years later, we had pretty much established the library, and then Michigan State provided a training program for librarians, and we sent out Mrs. Alibowicz, who was our reference librarian in East Lansing. She spent 2 years there whipping the new library into shape.